Today, the world is in denial. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. When we say denial, we're not about swimming. We're talking about people actually not seeing what is really going on.
No, denial is not just a river in Egypt, as the old cliche joke goes. You know, we see all this various commentary from politicians, from people in the market saying, you know, we're heading in the right direction at a great rate of knots. But, you know, I mean, you look at the various data points and it just really doesn't look all that rosy. It looks actually very, very poor.
It does. And interestingly, true here, but also true in a number of other countries too. And I guess the first point I want to make is that people seem to have forgotten a simple rule of mathematics, that if you go 50% down, right, you have to do more than the 50% back up again to get to the same point again. It's just a simple, you know, mathematical truth. So when people are now celebrating these massive percentage rises up, it's just not actually reflecting anything like what you need to do to get back to where you were.
No. Well, I mean, I see Trump, you know, going on Twitter and celebrating all these various achievements of, you know, creating X number of jobs, you know, X growth in retail sales, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, that's, and to be completely honest with you, it's not just Trump. It's the, you know, it's happening across the board. You're seeing all these people celebrating all these various month on month numbers, but they don't really tell you about the real truth of the matter of what's really going on. And more than that, but this is the numbers that we're achieving with World War II level stimulus. You know, this is the same. I mean, you know, the US is heading for, you know, some say a budget deficit of 27% of GDP, which, you know, is larger even than the height in the Second World War, when 9 million Americans were in uniform and they were building 100,000 aircraft a year.
Yeah, and it's just worth remembering that a lot of that Fed stimulus was being thrown in before the virus hit, right? So we had the September crisis last year with regard to the repo markets. People have forgotten about that, right? And there were already huge signs of stress and strain in the economies around the world, and then the virus is coming over the top. It seems to me that there's a lot of reinvention of history going on at the moment, which is, oh, it's the virus that did it, you know. We couldn't do anything about it. No. This is 10 years plus of bad policy all coming home to roost.
Absolutely. I mean, Japan was already in recession. France was already in recession. You know, a lot of the other European economies were heading that way. China wasn't faring all too well either. You know, we were already seeing problems there. In the US, you were seeing things like the job openings, the JOLTS index. You know, that was already starting to trend down, and that's usually a very, very solid indicator of further trouble ahead. And then obviously there's the inversion of the yield curve. You know, there is a long, long list of issues that we were, you know, long, long list of data points that were showing that we were heading for rather significant problems in the sort of, you know, next 12 to 18 months from, you know, when the virus kicked off. But, you know, obviously there's not really any political mileage in saying, oh, we were having problems before. It's much easier to just, you know, say, oh, look at the virus. The virus did it. You know, the virus is the problem.
Well, I often say plausible deniability is a wonderful thing, right? So essentially all of the stuff ups that have been going on for, you know, at least 10 years, I would say probably longer than that, close to 20 years, throwing more liquidity into the system to try and effectively prop the economy up, taking rates lower and lower. All of that was happening beforehand. And now politicians can turn around and say, well, the virus created the problem. And by the way, my high-frequency data from my surveys really lays bare some of this, right? In terms of, I can talk to households, and household stress is higher than it's ever been. That's both rental stress and mortgage stress. But I'm also looking at my SME survey data. And a few months ago, I started asking a question about to SMEs about whether they felt they would be still in business 6 months later, right? And the latest data is just out. And worryingly, if you look at the data, then it's roughly one third of businesses are now questioning whether it's likely that they will be around in the new year. One third, right? And it's actually in Victoria, it's actually higher than in some other postcodes and locations and states. But interestingly, the ACT is where there is less stress from the SME sector than anywhere else, because of course it's government money, which is always flowing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that really hits on an important issue that, you know, a lot of businesses are in trouble. A lot of things were already going wrong behind the scenes. I mean, one of my favorite statistics is that in the US, 7.4% of loans, mortgage loans, are being deferred. Here in Australia, it's 11%, and that was up to only June 30th. You know, we've still got the Victorian Stage 3 lockdown, the Victorian Stage 4 lockdown to be counted before we really get to the sort of real data. And I think that really just indicates what's wrong with Australia, compared with all these other countries, because, you know, America has 28 million people who are unemployed. You know, they're in serious, serious trouble, but somehow they have less mortgages being deferred than here in Australia, which completely boggles the mind. And it just goes to show how lax our lending standards have been and how much trouble we're in more broadly. I mean, you know, I did the math the other day. You know, if you take all of the various mortgages being deferred, strip out the ones that are still being paid in full, our current rate of mortgage arrears, based on that metric, is higher than those in the US during the height of the financial crisis. They're higher than The Big Short. You know, Australians make the stripper in The Big Short seem fiscally and financially responsible, you know, in relative terms.
Oh, The Big Short, one of my favourite all-time movies for all sorts of reasons, but partly because, of course, it tells a very cautionary tale. But look, here's the point, you know, and people need to come back to this. We've had very high debt, particularly for households, for mortgages for a long, long time. And if you look at the exposure that our banks have to the mortgage sector, it's, you know, 65% or thereabouts, right? In the US, the banks, they're around 30 to 32% exposed to mortgages. So that tells you something. And also, if you compare the debt-to-income ratios, it's just so much higher here. So it's just cheaper to buy property in the US relative to income than here. And so this mechanical process that we've had over the last decade plus, which is essentially, let's use households and, household wealth, quote unquote, from ever larger mortgages and therefore bigger house prices to try and drive the economy, coupled with, of course, migration. Those two levers were the ones that we have been pulled. Just shows how weak that argument is. And unfortunately, we're now starting to see the stresses and strains showing. You know, Westpac this week reported a significant uptick in delinquencies, 90-day delinquencies, by the way, despite the interest and principal holiday repayments, which are, under APRA rules, not counted in those numbers. So you're right, if you do the math on what the real story is with regard to delinquency, it is horribly high. And yet people are still saying, oh no, it's nothing to see here, you know, everything's fine. Just we'll lend some more money to more households and we'll offer some more first home owner grants and other bribes so that they can go and buy a property. And in fact, did you notice that the master builders and the HIA were spruiking yet more investment to support the construction sector? And indeed, there was even the suggestion that people should be able to pull money out of superannuation to be able to fund a deposit to buy a house. I'm thinking, don't they get what's really going on here? Don't they see that actually just digging a bigger debt hole is going to actually not help? Maybe I'm on the wrong planet, but from my perspective, this is so blooming obvious, I just can't believe that other people can't see it.
No, I completely agree with you. You know, sometimes I just feel like I'm smashing my head against the wall. I really do. You know, like I've been thinking about it just recently, and to be honest, I'm beginning to think that I'm an optimist. To be completely honest with you, I know it sounds crazy, and I know that I've got a bit of a reputation along with yourself for being a bit bearish, but you look at the data, you look at what's going on. You know, the massive, massive expenditure that's being thrown at the global economy, and we're treading water at best. You know, I really don't know where that ends. And I look at some of the sort of data, even for Australia in particular. Like I've been looking at the Bank of International Settlements, their data on debt service ratios, and Australians spend almost double what Americans do servicing their household debts. And when you really, really do a deep dive into US household debt, when you do a deep dive into the fact that they have enormous auto loan debt, they have enormous student loan debt. And once you strip that out and you do mortgage debt versus mortgage debt, it's enormous. It just shows how much of Australia's household income and, you know, our productive capacity is just completely blown servicing these debts. You know, it's almost like one in every, I think it's about nearly one in every $6 an Australian household earns goes into servicing their debts. And it's really quite mind-boggling, because that is going to hamper our recovery more than nearly any other developed nation on the face of the earth. But nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, well, here's the point, right? If you take the total household population in Australia, it's roughly a rule of thirds, right? There are around a third of Australians who are renting. There are a third of Australians who have property without mortgage. And there's a third of Australians who have mortgages, right? So that average number that everybody quotes actually completely distorts the reality, right? You've actually got to divide it by three, which basically means that rather than being, you know, close to 200, it's closer to 600, right? In other words, households with mortgages are massively leveraged up, right? And the point I often say is you've got to think about the marginal borrower here, right? Because you only need, you know, 4 or 5% of those to go wrong to be able to create a big enough crater in bank profitability and capital to create a financial crisis, right? It doesn't need everybody to fall over. So we are hugely vulnerable, right? Second point to make is a lot of those people who are living in their own property are older people who've been reliant on pension income and also income from superannuation. Now, of course, the issue there is that the stock market performance has been up and down all over the place, but they also have funds in deposits. And of course, deposit rates are now absolutely way down. So you've got, as well as those who are hugely mortgaged, you've got the one third who are basically sitting on lower income than they've ever had, because essentially all those other investment classes are actually not necessarily performing as well. And of course, dividends are being cut. So even if you hold shares, you're not going to get as much dividend now. Like, some banks are paying no dividends, some banks are paying small dividends. And then the third of people who are actually renting, now they've actually seen some drop in some rents, but many of them are on rent payment holidays at the moment. And there are a couple of things happening there which are very disturbing. Firstly, it's not clear for many of them whether in fact they are on a holiday or whether they're on a deferment. And that's pretty critical, right? Because does it mean that they owe the 6 months rent or what, how long it is later or not? That's not clear. And the second is, did you see that there was a report today that said a lot of them are now losing their bonds because of what's gone on? So whichever sector of the economy you look at, you can see that all of these crises, if you like, coming at the same time, which is why overall confidence is down, and which is why, despite the retail spending boom on white goods and other bits and pieces, thanks to the government checks, I suspect, and also panic buying because of what happened in Victoria, the overall economic scale looks pretty scary.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at, I think you hit on an important point, because it's not just one thing that's driving this struggle in the economy. It's all of these little cumulative factors that are all coming together to create a really, really unpleasant scenario for the economy and for households more broadly. Because like you say, for example, the dividend income, right? There, I believe that they reckon that the ABC estimated a few weeks ago that the decrease in dividend income being paid to Australians was going to be reduced. I think, I don't know if it's Australians or Australian retirees, I'm uncertain. But either way, it was around about $10 billion over the remainder of the year. And $10 billion is a lot of money. That's $10 billion that's not being spent. That's $10 billion that's not going to be subject to economic multipliers. That's not going to flow through the economy. That's not going to, you know, help us get out of this hole. And the problem is like you say, there's all these little different things being put together. There's the fact that the rental holidays or deferments are going to end. That's money that renters now have to give to their landlords that is not going to go into consumption, that's not going to be going into paying down debt or whatever it is that they choose to do with it. It's going to be going straight to the hand of the landlord. And not only that, but there's also, as we've discussed previously, there's no doubt going to be probably tens of thousands of people, you know, on the chopping block for evictions. because, you know, well, landlords need to get paid. It's just the way of the world. And all these various issues come together to create enormous social problems for a start. And then there's also the issue of lower interest rates, you know. So there's going to be all these retirees who are used to, you know, the ones who take, you know, they take the grandkids to Dreamworld in Queensland. You know, they take the grandkids on holiday with them when they go to Bali. They pay for the private schools. They do all these various different things, and they're not going to be able to afford that anymore. So that's even less money flowing through the economy. And I look at this withdrawal of stimulus to the tune of, what is it, about $60, $70 billion, depending on what estimate you go by. And that's just, that's effectively almost a, you know, a Great Depression level withdrawal of stimulus in and of itself. And then there's all these other factors that we're discussing, and it paints a really, really bleak picture, to be completely honest with you. And then I read about, you know, oh, unemployment's going to come down, oh, economic growth's going to bounce back, and I'm just like, how? If the math doesn't add up, seriously, you can get a grade 5 to just go 10 minus this minus this minus this equals negative GDP.
Well, of course, the other factor there is 30% of households have received some government support. 30%, right? Since the COVID crisis started. So basically, the story, the real story, is the only thing that's propping the economy up is all the government money that's been pouring in. But as you say, we're getting to the point now where they're wanting to turn the taps back. Although my own view is they'll have to change that. I wouldn't be surprised to see them continuing the stimulus for a lot longer. And they probably should, because without it, you know, there's really a very, very sad story to tell. And I guess the other point that I want to make is that unemployment is still forecast to go higher from where it is, right? The Reserve Bank is saying end of the year 10%, give or take, where it's, what, 7% now on the official numbers. Of course, the unofficial ones are probably more accurate and much higher. So it's not like we've hit the end of the crunch down. We're still in the foothills, heading uphill towards higher unemployment end of this year, and 7% plus in 2 years' time. So, you know, this is all about a long, slow grind, right? And I just can't see the policy settings and levers in place to be able to lay a foundation for getting out the other side. And remember all the conversations right from the Reserve Bank through to the Treasurer and indeed the PM about, you know, V-shape, build a bridge across. Well, I can tell you now that that bridge has got a very, very long span. And I think it's a bit wobbly at the far end, and it hasn't reached the other side yet.
If it's anywhere near the other side, I'd be astounded, to be completely honest with you. No, I look at the data, and it's just I wrote an article a few months ago in which I basically theorized that one of the biggest problems going forward is that at the moment we have this limbo moment. We have, you know, record high retail sales. We have, you know, household confidence probably higher than it should be, to be completely honest, in terms of the way people are approaching their own finances. And, you know, a few other indicators in those in that sort of vein. And that creates a real problem for the government, because you've got a party room full of people, maybe not full of people, that's a little bit unfair, but, you know, with a fair few people who are just going to look at these headline indicators and they're going to say, we've beaten this. Look at retail sales. They're fantastic. You know, look at this. That's fantastic. You know, we've achieved all this and we've achieved all that, and we should turn it all off. And that's what we saw a few months ago. You know, you saw, you know, Jason Falinski and a few other Liberal MPs coming out and saying we need to turn off JobKeeper as soon as possible to save the money, you know, to get the budget back in the black, and, you know, everyone gets their nice little Liberal Party mug so everybody's happy. And, you know, it speaks to the sort of, you know, lack of realism about this situation. But by the same token, I mean, in a way, you almost have to understand, because, you know, every time people have said, oh, Australia's in trouble, you know, we're going to have a big issue, we're going to have a big problem, somehow we've always found a way to avoid that. And people believe that that's what's going to keep happening. You know, the politicians believe it. The people in the street believe it. You know, I mean, I even look at some of these, you know, business confidence indexes and stuff like that. There has been some probably more improvement than's warranted, to be completely honest with you. You know, I mean, we've still got this insolvency wave coming later in the year. We've still got the tapering of various government stimulus programs later this year. And I don't really feel like any of that's really represented in the data just yet. It's just sort of, oh, well, hopefully Scobo was right and hopefully the bridge holds out and, you know, next year will be better. But I don't really think that's going to be true from an economic perspective, to be honest.
Yeah, well, there's that little thing in the strategy, right? So, you know, you do this, do this, do this, and then there's a big cloud and it says, and then a miracle happens, right? And magically everything's, that's where we are. There is somehow an expectation that this miracle is going to happen, and maybe it'll be the iron ore, and maybe it'll be China or whatever, right? But there is just no thorough thinking. And, you know, even Phil Lowe has been talking about we need more jobs, right? At a time when unemployment's rising and when effectively more small businesses are going out of business. I have to say that I'm not convinced that we have a plan. I'm not convinced that we actually have any idea about what we should be doing. And I don't know whether our politicians are up to it. But frankly, if they aren't up to it, they should get out of the way and find some people who actually really want to take this on and, you know, steer it towards a better outcome. Because just going back to what we would, well, where we were before, as we said in previous shows, is just not going to work. We need a different set of norms than we've currently got.
I completely agree with you. I mean, but by the same token, if you look around the world, they're not unique. They're not unique at all. You know, it's all just these stopgap measures, you know, just stop the bleeding, stem the bleeding. Everything's going to be okay. You know, we're going to find a way out of this and everything's going to snap back. And, you know, I'd love to get on the show and say, oh, it's just ScoMo screwing up, that he's the only leader in the world who's making mistakes, but he's not. You know, he is, I would say, you know, right bang in the middle of the way that this is being approached globally. You know, and I don't know if it's the fact that the economists and leaders and just people in general lack a frame of reference for an economic event of this scale and of this breadth, or if it's the fact that they just don't want to believe that it's a problem. Like, to put it in an analogy, I sort of view the entire thing with the virus and the subsequent lockdowns and the economic issues and the existing things a little bit like a natural disaster. So, you know, a hurricane hits a city, you know, like, say, for example, like Hurricane Katrina, hits it hard. There is, you know, the severe hardship, it hits everyone. But then what normally happens is you have everyone coming from all the surrounding areas to help rebuild. And that's what happens economically when a country goes into a recession. You know, what basically happens is over time it recovers, you know, it lowers its currency or it introduces stimulus policies, and then everyone just, all the capital piles in and everything recovers. But what's happened this time is it's like a hurricane hitting every city on the planet all at once.
Well, it is a global emergency, right? It's a global economic and healthcare emergency. And I don't think leaders around the world are really up to it. And by the way, I would say that the central coordinating bodies like the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements, et cetera, are running out with their high-level platitudes about working together and all those things, right? But they're not up to it either. So essentially, we've got a deficit of real insightful thoughts about how to deal with what we're dealing with. And look at the UK, for example, who've messed up, you know, student grades in the last couple of weeks, right? And they've seen a bounce down and a bounce back in GDP, and there was, you know, huge celebration of the GDP result, like I said, from a very low base. It's like wherever you look, you see the same basic issues and the same basic mistakes being made again and again. Maybe I'm just old, right? Maybe years ago, it's not true, but I feel that, you know, years ago, those leaders around the world actually had a bit more nous about them and had a bit more sense of what they needed to do to be able to, you know, take things forward. I just don't know whether the capability's gone down or whether I've just got old and suddenly get really cynical, but I have a feeling that overall capability is just lower than it used to be.
Well, I mean, I suppose that means I'm old too.
Well, if you're old, then what does that make me? I should be drawing my official, well, if I were to draw it, official pension this year. So, you know, it's sort of, but, you know, if I think back through to the, you know, the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, you know, politicians weren't perfect. But there were some people who I think were a bit visionary, but also were prepared to take on some of the hard issues. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's always been like this, and maybe I just wasn't close enough to see that they were always making it up as they go along, frankly, you know, taking tactical decisions for political ends and not thinking strategically, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that is true. But, you know, frankly, something like Clinton looks like, quite like a visionary leader, which I wouldn't have said at the time, but there you go.
Richard Nixon would be doing a much better job, to be completely honest with you.
Yes. And he'd have all the evidence because he'd be recording as well.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, you know, like, if you look at the situation from a historical perspective, the precedents are all there. You know, you read about the Depression. If you go into a deep dive into how the Depression played out, into the contagion that spread around the world, and then you look at it from the perspective of the fact that it's all happening at once rather than just, you know, leapfrogging around the world slowly but surely, it really does, you know, indicate the scale of the problem. But also, once again, looking at it from a historical perspective, unlike Franklin Roosevelt or unlike, you know, other Depression era leaders, we have a playbook. We're not going into this situation completely blind. You know, we have, you know, decades and decades of well-documented history from all these various leaders that we can call on, people who are still alive today, who we could get in a room with Trump or ScoMo or whoever it is and hammer out a better plan for the future. But that's not what's happening. No one is, I mean, I can't think of a single leader who has a very wide-ranging, comprehensive, well, let's be honest, leader of a major nation. I'm sure that there are, you know, people in, you know, random countries who have fantastic leadership, but, you know, not in a sort of, you know, G20 nation, really. And we're lacking vision, we're lacking anything. But I think more than anything, it all comes back to the title of this video. It's about denial. It's about not accepting the scale and the absolute crapshoot that we find ourselves in.
You know, the fact is that many of the decisions which are being taken are tactical, political. I agree, it's awkward. I mean, it's difficult. This is not a simple and straightforward issue. But I also make the point that a lot of the decisions that have been taken, particularly by central banks, are actually buttressing the position of the financial system and of the few percent who own most of the assets and the richest, you know, and the rest of the world effectively are just, you know, picking up the pieces or the crumbs. And it's this distortion that I'm more worried about than anything else, this continued perpetuation of, you know, protecting a small number of people against the greater population. And for me, that's the fundamental value question, you know, not value in terms of dollars, but value in terms of morals, which I think is really where the discussion needs to start, because we are in the situation, and it's partly the neoliberal approach to things, right, where effectively those in power and those buttressed by the wealthy around them feel as though they're doing well because they're still okay, whereas in fact the rest of society is falling apart at the edges and, you know, looking at social issues and looking at, you know, the degrade of wealth for everybody else makes it a completely disorientating and unequal discussion. And yet, frankly, the people in power really don't seem to care. And maybe they do care, but they don't seem to care.
No. No, there's no, like, there are slam dunk, easy peasy policy moves that they could take. You know, so for example, ScoMo could get up there tomorrow and say all federal MPs are going to take a 10% pay cut temporarily, you know, until unemployment's under X or until we have achieved Y, whatever it is. You know, we're going to recommend that all the various state and territory leaders and elected officials also take pay cuts and also talk to the public service about pay cuts in certain areas with jobs that earn over X amount of money per year. You know, no Australian should be struggling while we're getting paid all this money. You know, it's an absolute piss easy slam dunk that he can announce to the high heavens and go on about and on and on and on and on like he does and score major political points. It's just obvious, you know, dumb stuff that really, that in reality really accomplishes nothing in terms of, you know, I mean, it's going to add, maybe another couple of $100 million to the federal budget, you know, across all of the various public service cuts. But that's it. It's not a lot, but it's a message. It's a narrative that says we are with you. We care. But like you say, that's just not happening. And I think that's emblematic of what we're seeing around the world. The elite in so many countries has become so disconnected from the reality of people in you know, the reality of people in the street, that they can no longer adequately relate. And that's a key thing. You know, there's a reason why the French elite didn't really survive the revolution, because they didn't listen. You know, and the American elite in a lot of ways are even worse, because I don't think that even Marie Antoinette would have been silly enough to be thinking, oh, you know, 15-20% of the pre-virus workforce don't have a job. Yeah, let's cut their unemployment benefits. That sounds like a fantastic idea. Let them eat cake.
Well, I interviewed the economist Michael Hudson some time ago, right? And he explained to me something which I'd sort of always known, but only intrinsically recognized until, you know, quite recently. And that is that the whole of the economic structures that exist are effectively aligned to the benefit of that top of the pyramid, you know, the affluent few. And effectively, you've then got, you know, call it wage slaves or whatever you want to call it, but effectively you've got the rest of society in a similar state to what it was many decades ago or centuries ago, you know, back in Rome or whenever, right? Things haven't really progressed that much, right? Because essentially it's the preservation of the wealth in the small proportion of people, right, at the expense of everybody else. And he makes the point, and I think it's so, you know, powerful now. The more money they throw into the financial system, the more money they put into supporting the existing economic structures, the more that flows back negatively onto the rest of society. Because, you know, frankly, there's nobody else other than taxpayers at the end of the day to pick up the tab, right? And so all of the stuff that's going on at the moment is in this, you know, mode where effectively small numbers of people are benefiting, and we'll probably do quite well out of it, and we'll be able to speculate and invest and do all the things right. But everybody else is there, you know, trying to do what they do. And interestingly, he said, do you realise that there used to be a thing called, you know, a debt jubilee, a debt forgiveness, right? And there was a sense to that, because it was, they realised many, many, you know, centuries ago that if you put too much burden on, you know, ordinary people in society, eventually society falls apart, right? And yet the one thing that neoliberalism holds to firmly today is if you have a debt, that debt always has to be repaid, right? And so his argument is we haven't really progressed at all from ancient Greece or Rome. The same models exist, the same set of values exist, the same few benefit, and everybody else basically picks up the pieces.
Yeah. It's a hard conclusion to disagree with, but the difference in today's world is that the gap between, like, just, you know, say the example of the Romans. You know, people had a very, very basic expectations about what they were due from their leaders, about what their leaders should do for them. You know, in the modern world, obviously our expectations are very, very different, and I think that's really part of the problem, because the Romans, for example, or any other, you know, empire or any other set of elite, they, you know, well, ones that they were doing the right thing anyway, they realized that you need the bread and circuses. You need to provide a certain level of support for the populace to justify your own existence as the elite, as the, you know, as the upper echelon of society. But we're not seeing that. Like, you know, say, for example, during World War One, you know, the British elite went off to fight. Yes, okay, they probably didn't go off to fight and get in the trenches in the same way as my great-grandfather did, but they were there, you know. And by the same token, if they opened up their manor, their big stately homes to the wounded of the war, they made an effort to, at the very least, even if they didn't believe what they were doing, they did something to justify their own existence, to justify the fact that they got a bigger slice of the pie than everybody else. And those sorts of actions are common throughout history. But in more recent times, because the elite is no longer, well, at least outside of Europe, because the elite is no longer an established aristocracy, you know, with roots going back centuries, it's, you know, it's the Jeff Bezoses, it's the Mark Zuckerbergs, it's the you know, the new rich. They don't have the same experience in managing a society, because that's the way it used to be. It used to be the aristocracy all got together with the monarch and they'd all decide, okay, we need to do this to satisfy the people. You know, I mean, some of my family a long, long time ago used to do that. So I've heard all the various stories, and that's the way it works. But they don't do that anymore. there is no formal contract to look after the everyday people. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that we face today, because the elite just look at it, and rather than say, like, you know, the turn of a century when they were forced to make an effort, they just sort of look at it and they go, well, it's not my problem. This is capitalism, buddy. Deal with it.
Well, I think you made the point exactly right, that it is a form of capitalism, right? Although I'm not sure it's the only form of capitalism that you have, but I think it comes back to a fundamental moral and ethical question, right? Which is, what is society for, right? If society is ultimately to create wealth for the few, well, that's the model that I think we're in at the moment. So effectively, there are a relatively small number of people around the world who are doing extremely well, thank you. And, you know, if you look at the Apple, $2 trillion equity, I think it is now, you know, it's gone through the roof. But if that is at the expense of everybody else, which is what it seems to me to be, then the moral code and standards that you have and the values that you apply are really faulty, right? And it seems to me, and I've said this a few times, and I often think it probably is the most critical thing, we have to turn this around and basically say, no, the idea is that the people who are actually in positions of responsibility and power and wealth should be there in a supporting role and enabling role to enable the broader society to grow and develop and flourish. In other words, the outcome should not be just more wealth for the few, right? The outcome should be a better society for you and me and everybody else in it, right? Now, if we started from that particular perspective, right, and built a set of policies and a way of thinking from that, you'd end up in a very, very different place. But I think a world that will be fairer, and actually one where some of the challenges that we face could be handled, because a lot of the policy decisions or a lot of the issues that are not being handled are not being handled because people decide they want to do other things, right? You know, like, for example, giving more money to the construction sector so that they can go build more houses that we don't need, right? Whereas if you actually said, no, we're going to put this money into other things where it can, you know, have different outcomes. So there are policy decisions that could be taken, but the basic ethical and moral platform against which decisions are being taken are warped.
Yeah, I agree. I've been sort of trying to approach this, you know, sort of current problem, you know, current issues, current crisis, from a sort of historical perspective. And I think to myself about, you know, sort of the mid to late 1920s, you know, about how affluent, educated, integrated societies fell apart, how they turned from democracy to authoritarianism, to fascism, to communism, to all these different various, you know, ideologies and well, you know, extremism relative to the political and ideological landscape of the way things were before. And, you know, you can't help but see the similarities. But I think one of the more concerning things is that in the 1920s, people's expectations of their leaders was a lot lower than what we expect from our leaders. You know, the ideas of, you know, sort of wide-ranging universal healthcare, you know, the social contract, the welfare safety net, all these sort of various things, you know, weren't there. We didn't have those expectations. Not only that, but we didn't have afterpay. We didn't have debts, and we, you know, of the magnitude that we have today, you know, like all this household debt, you know, that we were talking about before, particularly, as you say, concentrated in the hands of relatively few. And it's really hard to see sort of a really positive outcome without major change. Because if not, people are just going to turn to the extremists. They're going to turn to people who promise to solve their problems, because right now the elite don't care. The, you know, ScoMo gets up there, talks about all his bull, but at the end of the day, that's not going to solve Joe Average's problem. Nor is Trump or Boris Johnson or Merkel or any other leader for that matter. It's not ideological. It's just the fact that people have expectations that aren't being met, and I'm afraid that they won't be met.
No, we often have heated agreements, and I'm afraid we are again. But you know, the fact is that if you measure success of an economy by gross domestic product, which is more and more activity, right, then you're going to be you fail at the first hurdle, right? there has to be a different set of measurement parameters and a different set of understandings about why society is where it is and what we're trying to do, right? Then from there, what you do is you begin to build policies out that tackle some of the social integration issues and, you know, the life issues that people have. And, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't allow people to be able to, you know, develop profit out of activity and those sorts of things. But there's a degree, and at the moment we've gone right off the end of the scale to the point where effectively a lot of the things that should be being addressed to make society better and, you know, the lives of average Australians better are just being ignored and just sort of saying it's too hard, you know, we'll focus over here, we'll focus at big business, we'll focus in the construction sector, whatever it is, right? But it's that fundamental philosophical starting point which I think is missing, right? And I'd also say, I don't know what you think, but I think both sides of politics are missing in action when it comes to that fundamental moral fibre that should be driving what they're actually at.
Yeah, it's a hard conclusion to disagree with, to be completely frank. Like, I'd love to get up here and say, oh, no, this party in this country is bang on and, you know, they're all going to, you know, achieve greatness and stuff. But, you know, I mean, in my experience, sometimes with politicians, it just becomes, you know, power for power's sake. You know, you compromise to get into a position where you can make a difference, and then you realize that when you actually try to go make a difference, that nobody else wants to. I mean, I think you made a good point in the sense that there needs to be a balance between profit and outcomes for the everyday people. I mean, arguably the greatest era for the West was the sort of period after World War II until maybe early to mid 1970s, in terms of, you know, like the slice of the pie kept growing for everyone. You know, the middle class and the lower classes, you know, saw very, very strong income growth, you know, very, very strong increase in outcomes and life expectancy and all the sort of various metrics. And I think, I mean, I know there are going to be people who disagree with this, but it's really not that difficult to press a balance, to say we can achieve both, to say that we can, you know, address the fact that people have mental health issues, or the fact that we have homelessness, or the fact that we have all these other problems. But by the same token, I agree that it does need to be some sense of, there does need to be some sense of, you know, incentive of a profit motive for people to, I mean, I don't care about billionaires or people getting rich. That's great. You know, I mean, the only thing I wish is that I was one of them, and I could probably make a much better difference. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't begrudge people their success, and I think that we should wish people all the success in the world. But I think that with the fruits of that of some of that success, that we should redirect that at actual genuine outcomes for real people. Because what's happening now is we take the success of corporations, of, you know, the big companies exporting their tens of billions of dollars of iron ore a year, and then we give it away in the form of negative gearing, or we give it away in the form of franking credits that wealthy people don't need. And I mean, and I tried to have this conversation with Chris Bowen before the last election, but he ignored me. And and I made the point that what's needed is something fair, something that allows people that to aspire to a better life, to aspire to a better world for their kids. And if you want negative gearing to build a property, provide housing supply, fantastic. It's all yours. You want franking credits to provide a modest retirement, or even a relatively decent retirement? Great, that's fine. But when you start, at the end of the day, that's not what happens. The benefits all flow to the wealthy. And that's the distinction I think that needs to be made. No one says people can't get, like, that's what Labor need to get up and do. They need to say, we love free enterprise. We love people making profits. We love people getting rich. But what we want is something fairer, something where everybody benefits too. But we're not anti-business. And that's the problem that a lot of left-wing parties are making, a mistake that they're making in the UK. They made it with Jeremy Corbyn. And it wouldn't surprise me if they make the same mistake again in the US with Biden.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. And, you know, this shows you, I guess, part of the complexity, but also I think the simplicity beyond the complexity, right? Because if you really do start from the question of, what is society for, how do we actually make society more able to prosper, then I actually think, you know, the building of profit out of that and creating a bigger economy makes a lot of sense. But you have to do it in a way where the gradient between the really, really rich and the rest of society is not completely out of kilter. You know, the CEO's salary relative to the average worker has gone way off the scale here, as in the US. In fact, in the US, it's disgusting, frankly. So it requires a different set of values and norms, right? But it also requires, therefore, people to go into bat for the more voiceless and, you know, those who are less able to actually argue for their own position and, you know, their own outcomes. And that's another thing that I get quite annoyed about, which is that there are very, very strong lobby groups, you know, the property sector being a good example, who are always in your face and always lobbying, you know, here is what the government should do for the budget in October, right? But there are other more voiceless groups and communities in society that don't get a look in. And for me, that's got to be part of the new model to get a better set of understandings of what levers we should be pulling. Because like I keep saying, there are always choices, right? And implicitly or explicitly, politicians are making choices all the time about backing this horse or backing that horse or doing this or doing that, right? But unless we've got the right moral framework within which those decisions are taken, it's always going to be pear-shaped. It's always going to be the status quo that's being supported. It's always going to be designed to ensure that they get re-elected next time, rather than the critical outcome, which is actually the future enhancement of society, which for me is the acid test.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'd really like to think that Australians can, I mean, you know, once upon a time, you know, we pretty much led the world in economic output. Once upon a time, we led the world in sort of, you know, rights for say for women to vote. You know, we can again, but to be honest, Australians in general are some of the most apathetic people on the face of the planet.
Well, the weather's generally nice. Let's go down to the beach, watch the footy, and she'll be right. Except it's not.
No, it's not. And I mean, I think that that's why in the next few years, America is going to be a very interesting bellwether, to be honest with you, because they're further down that road towards the divided society, towards the divide between rich and poor than we are. Yep. And unlike us, they have 400 million unregistered firearms. So unlike us, the people have a great deal of leverage. You know, if you know, you do start to see large-scale civil unrest and people walking through the streets with, you know, assault rifles, then... You know, I think that you'll sort of you will see some change forced, but here in Australia, I don't really see any of that vision from anyone. I mean, like, I suppose you sort of see some of it to a degree from the Greens, but it's condensed through such a narrow ideologically driven lens that it just ends up being, I don't know, just not really much of anything at all, to be honest with you. I mean, we need, you know, a plan to because this, to be honest with you, this isn't even about the stuff that we normally talk about anymore. This isn't even about, you know, improving society or housing the homeless or all those sorts of things. That's become sort of a desirable secondary objective. But this is about maintaining the cohesion of our society through a difficult period. And that's the way it needs to be viewed by the politicians, because it's not just about, you know, improvement or about moral values or all these various different things. They need to really get down to the nitty-gritty and realize that it's about the survival of their political class.
Well, I actually think it's not only that, but it is actually about the survival of Australia as a free and fair country and the moral values that we aspire to, right? I mean, what I'm, I guess, saying, and I think, you know, this is a step down from the political environment, the decisions that are taken now and over the next couple of years will set up or create failure for our country for, you know, the next 20 or 30 years. And the risk is you end up effectively going down the cul-de-sac a bit like the US has gone, right? Because we are heading in that direction, and it seems to me we're heading more and more in that direction as we go. And unless we actually have people who begin to say, no, there is a different narrative, a different outcome, a different set of end goals that we should be achieving, that's where we're going to end up, because pretty much everybody in mainline politics is heading off in that same direction. So I guess my plea is now is the time to articulate a better alternative view and then translate that into different investments and different policies, because it is conceivable to do that. And yet, frankly, there aren't very many people here in Australia who I think are willing and able to take that on board and begin to march with it. So it's a bit gloomy, I'm afraid, but you know, I think there's an opportunity, there's a window, but unfortunately I'm not sure that anybody's going to climb through it and sort of take us in a different direction.
Well, to do my thing and expand on your gloom,
feel free.
Yeah. The problem is that we need a plan yesterday. We needed a plan 6 months ago, to be completely honest with you. You know, I mean, we're going to have a wave of insolvency starting in September. We're going to have one of the biggest decreases in stimulus, one of the biggest peacetime decreases in stimulus in the history of the bloody world. And there are already so many people who are going to lose their jobs, who are going to lose their businesses, like you were saying with your SME survey, up to 30% of businesses potentially closing. I mean, we're already right up the creek without a paddle, like as it stands today, right here, right now. And there's no plan. There's no plan whatsoever. There's no plan for a recovery. There's nothing. And it's not just Australia. It's the whole world. And that's what just makes this denial from leaders, from economists, from all these different people so frustrating that I just feel like smashing my head against the wall for an hour, that they just do not realize or accept the absolutely dire reality of the situation, that we need a plan to recover tomorrow, because the wheels of politics move slowly and this needs to get done. Because if we don't, I haven't even thought about what kind of world that's going to be, because frankly I don't want to unless I absolutely have to.
Well, you know what they say about the first step of a journey is to take the first step of the journey, right? But the first thing you have to do is to understand where you are, so on the map, as it were, right? Because otherwise, wherever you go, you don't know where you're going to end up, right? And my argument is the map, if you did but read it, is quite clear in terms of where we currently are, right? All the economic indicators. So now we actually need to take the first step in a new direction, right? Just going back and doing a bit of tax cutting and bring forward some of the stuff they were going to do anyway in October, right? Ain't going to cut the mustard, right? There has to be an alternative approach, an alternative route cast. And yet many people still don't even, haven't got the map open yet, right? They're still looking at the picture on the cover thinking, oh, it's looking very nice. Yeah, they're fine. This is an urgent and critical task, which unfortunately I worry that people are not taking serious enough. But we'll keep on watching, Tarek. We'll keep on sharing our views and shouting from the rooftops. And I try not to bang your head against too many walls, because the walls tend to answer back.
Yeah, mate. Hopefully we do see some positive change, but I'm not so hopeful. And just to finish on a sort of gloomy, even gloomier point, my concern is that the governments are just going to sort of keep playing stimulus whack-a-mole, and the central banks are just going to keep inflating this bloody bubble.
Could well do. And interestingly, I was talking to Harry Dent today, and he said, look, they will run out, because you have to continue the stimulus at not linear, but a logarithmic level to be able to just keep it going, right? And so at some point quite soon, it's just going to stop. And that's why he's still of the view that the future is deflationary, not inflationary. So, there's a lot to play for here. But, we're not even off first base yet. Anyway, we'll keep chatting and, let's try and not be too negative. I'm still very optimistic about people and about the fact that actually society is made up of people who actually, I think, are underrated as a species, generally. Politicians, on the other hand, are overrated as a species, and maybe we need less of them and we need more people with, a better sense of balance to be able to take more control of what's going on.
No, exactly. I mean, I've known some fantastic people in my life, people I've met through charities and various volunteer groups, and, they do amazing things with very, very little. And it's not that I don't have faith in in sort of people as a whole. It's the fact that our leadership is just so awful. If you want to replace them with charity volunteers and, you know, people who give up their time to help people tomorrow, I'd be a whole lot more optimistic than I would be with the current jokers we have running this planet.
Okay, we have to junk the political machine and get a voluntary parliament in place. I'll second that.
Well, that's two. We're halfway there.
Tarek, good to talk to you. Take care.
Yeah, you too, mate. Bye.
Cheers.